I've gotten lots of questions about various aspects of epidurals because there is a lot of like myths too around epidurals. 15 to 25% of women are going to have a fever. Because we don't know if it's from the epidural or if there's from an infection going on in you, your baby may have to undergo sepsis evaluation. But then yeah, sometimes it doesn't work, or sometimes it only works on one side. And so the statistical rate of it not working at all is like 5 to 10%. Welcome back to Healthy as a Mother. I am your co-host, Dr. Morgan McDermott, and this is the show for becoming and being a mother, where Dr. Leah and I share our natural women's health and motherhood guidance that you've been looking for through our fresh, functional, and balanced lens. And today, we are teaching you all about epidurals. So consider this Epidurals 101. We are going to talk about the history of pain medication use in labor. We talk about the components of an epidural, the ingredients, how are they placed, tips and tricks for that. Some of the side effects. So that's kind of the big main one that people want to know. What are the side effects to mom? What are the side effects to baby? When can you get one? When can't you get one? What are my personal feelings and philosophies around the use of epidural and the planning of a birth plan with pain augmentation or not? So this is another hefty episode, as we tend to deliver here at Healthy as a Mother. So let's go ahead and dive in.
All right, we are back and we are doing a Epidurals 101 episode. Dr. Morgan is going to break this down. She is going to be telling us all the things, and then I can give my little, you know, two cents since I've had one. But yeah, let's just take it away and teach us everything about epidurals.
Oh my gosh, that's right. You didn't have two because they tried.
They even tried. With my second.
They were going to give you like a spinal anesthetic.
Oh yeah, they did. They tried to give me a spinal tap, which I guess maybe you could explain the difference between that and an epidural, because they're not the same, correct? Yeah.
Right, yeah.
So my first birth was an epidural, and my second, they tried to give me a spinal tap, and then it didn't work. And then they were trying to like cut me open before I was numb, and so then they had to give me general in my second, which was, none of it was fun, but.
Yeah, not fun. Okay. I'm so sorry about that. Okay. So yeah, let's just go into it. So I've gotten lots of questions about various aspects of epidurals and my thoughts on them and whatever. And so decided to make a whole episode that kind of details the history and what are the ingredients and what are the side effects and what does the research say about various things? Because there is a lot of like myths too around epidurals. And although I am very pro natural birth because I do think it has a physiological purpose. I do think that our culture is really afraid of the experience of it. And I think there's actually a lot of women who love it. And so I want that voice to be heard more. I do see a time and a place for epidural. I'm not the type of person who's like, they should never exist. I think that kind of surprises people. I don't know. I guess like what everybody needs to learn about me and you is like, we are not super beholden to every dogmatic ideal of the natural world. Like, it makes so much more sense to me to try to do things the way that your body would naturally do them. And then when you need to tap into medicine, you do. But that's not the
default. Do no harm. I mean, that's like the number one principle of medicine in general, which everyone should be practicing, but they see that as different. And sometimes the less harm is doing something like an epidural, because there's more harm coming from, you know, killing yourself trying to have a natural birth. Same with any other thing. Like, the tools are there. It's how they're used and in what order and in what situation. And at the end of the day, do less harm. A lot of times we are giving too much intervention, and that is doing more harm than if we were just to let things happen physiologically. And so at the end of the day, like, that's what it boils down to. Like, I feel like you and I share that principle of do less harm, follow the intervention ladder of like less intervention up, but sometimes less harm is that intervention, right?
Yes, exactly. I love that. That's such a good framework to think about it, because it really puts everything into perspective. It's like there is a time and a place where that is going to be the best choice, because maybe the mother's so exhausted, she can't keep going and she's going to have a cesarean. Then let's try to do an epidural she can sleep and maybe have a vaginal birth, which would be like one step above if we can. You know what I mean? There is a hierarchy. People love to act like there's not. It's like, they're like, no, formula is the exact same as breast milk. And vaginal birth versus cesarean, it doesn't matter. And it's like, no, it does. And that doesn't mean that people who get cesareans are like terrible moms or like the devil. You know what I mean? Like, why can those feelings not be held in the same sentence? It's so weird. It's like we want to just be so black and white and like, if not this, then terrible. So anyways, okay, so let's just talk a little bit about the history of pain augmentation in labor, because I think that it gives some context and it's really interesting. And there was a lot of stuff in researching for this episode that I did not know.
I love history.
So so this will be good. The history of obstetrics, actually, I really want to have Lindsay, I actually don't know how to pronounce her last name, Mihalis, on the podcast to talk about obstetric history, because she talks about it in such a beautiful way. And like the way that midwifery is all wrapped up into it. I mean, she's like a birth celebrity. She's so cool and she's very busy, but we've been trying to schedule for a long time together. Anyways, it would be just so cool to hear the whole thing because it has a really dark past. Okay. So before 1847, guys, we're like in Bridgerton era.
This is a little bit before World War the Civil War, right? I think Civil War was 1860s.
Gosh, asking the wrong person.
I think it's like a little bit before the Civil War. Yeah. Like put people in that
so
time frame.
Before that time, like 1847 is a pivotal year for this, I guess. So before then, we did sometimes use like herbal sedatives or opium or alcohol in labor. But it actually overall, the idea and narrative was not that birth needed to be medically managed or augmented. It was sort of considered like natural, moral. It was sort of like woman's duty. It was even almost considered like a religious thing. Then sometime after that, in the late 1840s through the 1900s, Queen Victoria used chloroform for her own births, and then it became socially acceptable to be fully unconscious and have your baby pulled out of you, basically. So this became like acceptable because of the way that she had done it. And so, yes, there's definitely more risks and issues, but it was finally now this concept entering society that pain should be eliminated. Like, why are women going through this? Or, oh, wait, this is better somehow. So then we messed around with a lot of different ways to do that. So for instance, in 1898, somebody decided to inject cocaine near the spinal cord and proved that it does block nerves. Instead of sedating like the entire body in the way that some of the other forms did, they just were able to block the nerves like that. But it caused like a really, really bad headache and blood pressure drops that were very unstable and hard to predict. So at this time, though, it wasn't used in labor. This was used for like surgeries. So, but we were getting closer to the idea of an epidural. But so somebody used this idea of like, how can we block nerves in the body? And they were using it for surgery, but it was like not used in labor just yet. Then we had this moment of the twilight era of sleep, which is my grandma gave birth. I wish so badly. She's been passed now for several years. She was 98 when I was 21, and that's when she passed. And so she was a very old grandma for me, like the way that my dad's on the younger side of five, and then I was his youngest child. So anyway, my grandma was really old for me. And I so wish I could have asked her more about this, because I know that this is how her babies were born. And she, at her death, was like 4'10", 4'10". She claimed she was 5'2" at some point in her life, which is like just not possible. But she gave birth to over 10-pound kids multiple times. And they ended up being type 1 diabetics, which is interesting. And also like 6'2 and 6'5, like humongous sons. But anyways, so during the twilight era of sleep, this is where they use morphine and scopolamine. And they would basically erase the memory of the pain of the woman. So she would like be in pain and be experiencing the whole thing and was tied down and restrained and often had like a covering over her face, experiencing the entire thing. Totally like crazy. I cannot even imagine what that would be like. But then it would erase her memory of it. So she would just like wake up and have no memory of the pain, which is also how they used to do surgeries a little bit too, where they would like have to perform, you know, an amputation or something really hardcore, and they would just do it while you were conscious and awake. But then this medication would prevent you from remembering it.
Oh my God, that is, but I'm sure the body remembered.
Totally. Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, like, isn't that crazy? Okay, so then by 1931, the first epidural was discovered, or not discovered, sort of discussed and outlined by a Spanish military surgeon. And 10 years later, the first one was used in childbirth. So 1941,
the first epidural was used, and it was a lumbar epidural later on, but this first, very, very first one was a continuous catheter kind of closer to the tailbone, like really low. So they were trying to figure out what level of the spine to put it at.
I would hate to be the one that they're experimenting on that.
Yeah.
Oh my God, there's so much damage that you could do. Oh God.
Can you imagine? I literally cannot imagine the number of, like injuries, casualties, different things like that. So the first one that was placed, you know, in the lumbar area was in those early 1950s. By the 1970s, so 20 years later, it was routinely used in hospitals. So big advancements in that 20-year chunk. Also, there was just more hospital births happening by the 1970s, not as many home births. And then we were doing things like, you know, pushing on flat on the back and continuous fetal monitoring. And we were having all these rising intervention rates in hospitals. And so that was kind of just like an interesting time. Everything was really rapidly changing. We were kind of trying to figure it out. And so then now since the 1990s through till now, low dose modern epidurals are the standard. Okay. Mm-hmm. So they're done in almost every hospital, not all, but almost every hospital, you know, depending on the size. And it's a very common thing. It's usually women's plan A, and we'll talk about that later. Mm-hmm. But so I kind of wanted to give how do we figure this out? And you know, it wasn't without a lot of trial and error and weird things going mm-hmm. on. Probably a lot of harm done in an effort to try to find something to reduce harm in one way or another. So let's talk about the ingredients. This is going to vary by hospital and by anesthesiologist. There is sort of a formula of three main ingredients, but like the individual medication that they choose of each of those main ingredients or main components can vary. The dosages can vary. So like when we say epidurals have this, it's not always exactly mm-hmm. like that because there is a little bit of variability. Yeah. So the first aspect is that there's a local anesthetic that blocks the nerve signals. This can be bupivacaine. It can be something different. Most of the time it is bupivacaine. I don't really know how to say that word properly. In my head, it sounds a lot better than when I say it out loud, but this is very dilute. Then there is an opioid. So this is the part that people really don't love, which I understand. So there is an opioid, and this improves pain relief without increasing the motor block. Fentanyl is the most common opioid that they use in an epidural, but sometimes they also use sufentanil. But it's a very, very, very small dose, and it acts more locally at the spinal cord than like throughout the entire body. You can, though, as a different labor medication, get an IV of like morphine or fentanyl. Mm-hmm. So that would be much more systemic. An epidural would actually expose you to less fentanyl than that mm-hmm. other route. Then there's like a carrier solution of saline. Sometimes they also have to put in a little bit of epinephrine or bicarbonate. And sometimes those are used to like speed it up or to act as like a, there's this technique of the way that they like low resistance, something, whatever it is. But so sometimes those are also in there, not all the time. So basically it's a local anesthetic of bupivacaine with an opioid and with saline. Yeah. Okay. And the opioid is a small dose.
Yeah. And a quick aside, I feel like it is nice for women before they have a birth, whether they plan on having a hospital birth or not, to know that going in, because when I got bills after the fact for fentanyl, like every day to my home, and they're like, here's your next $1,700 bill for fentanyl. And I had zero idea that I was given fentanyl. It was very shocking and very disorienting because I didn't even know I was getting fentanyl, and then I had to pay a bunch of money for it. And so, yeah, just knowing, I mean, I'm assuming unless they gave me extra fentanyl that was not in the epidural, maybe that's what happened. I have no idea. Like, why would you?
I feel like they wouldn't break apart the components of it in billing you. I think that they probably gave you extra like IV fentanyl or something like that, because otherwise why would they? They would just report it as
I'm like very upset about it. I'm just like, why one would you not ask for my permission and then send me a bunch of bills for it? It was very frustrating.
Yeah. And unfortunately that is a common thing, and it comes a really common one that I, hear about with that is postpartum Pitocin use for the delivery of the placenta. And people just don't even know if you already have an IV going, they will sometimes just push it in there without telling you. And it's like, you know, you have your baby on your chest, you're having this moment, and maybe they do say it. And it's like in one ear, out the other because of what's going on in the room. But a lot of the time they say nothing and they just do it because it's standard routine. And I just don't think that that's right. But anyways, okay. What about all the tubing? What are we talking? So I just want to talk about what it is and what you're going to see. So there's like a needle, a catheter. A catheter is like, you know, often when we say that word, I think people think about a urethral catheter so that they can pee. And like, yes, basically it's a small, thin plastic tube that will be fed in through the needle. So like the needle goes in to make the path, just like when you're getting your ears pierced and you get pierced by a hollow needle. The needle goes in and it's hollow, and then the catheter is fed through the middle of it, and then the needle is retracted. And so what's left is this very thin, plastic, flexible thing. It's not like you have a hard needle in your back the entire time. And then there's like this little infusion pump that's going to deliver the medication. And then there's all this like sterile drapes and gloves. And there is a local lidocaine shot too to numb you for that placement of the needle so that you shouldn't feel it. I don't, did you feel it?
I mean, you feel a poke, but it's probably the initial, you know, lidocaine poke.
Lidocaine.
But, I mean, having a needle in your spine is never fun. But, you know, I mean, I've had way worse pain than that. So for me, it wasn't like terrible, but it's not fun to like have a needle in your back.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not like, woo-hoo,
I think
let's do it again.
The anticipation of it is always worse. In every blood draw situation, people's hyped up anxiety of the needle is coming makes it so much worse. Than if of the actual pain of a needle poke, at least in my opinion.
No, I would agree with that. It's like when you're at the dentist and you have to get numbed for something, just waiting for them to do it. It's like terrible. And then when they do it, you're like, oh, okay. that wasn't that bad. okay. So what's a spinal tap? So first of all, I did poll you guys on your questions on Instagram, and I have worked in all of your answers into this lecture.
Yeah, this is a lecture. This is school. Healthy as a mother.
Yeah, welcome to Healthy as a Mother school. Sit down, class. You have a report due at the end of this. Okay, that's actually so funny. We should. This that's kind of what it is.
It 100% is.
We should rebrand. Yeah. Being a university.
More. We should have college intuition.
We should definitely get paid more. That's for sure. The amount of hours that we spend on some of these preps, you guys have no idea. Okay. Anyways, so a spinal tap. So people are like, what's the difference between a spinal and epidural? Good question. So a spinal is often just a one-time dose. It's placed deeper. So there's like multiple layers around our spinal cord of these like thick connective tissues that make these different pockets and spaces. And an epidural is placed in the epidural space. And a spinal is placed one layer like deeper. Mm-hmm. Spinals work really fast, and they're mostly used for like surgeries or for a cesarean. So like you got one of those with Cade's birth, but then it like didn't work well.
Unfortunate.
So then they had to put you under general anesthesia. Okay, but so a spinal tap, a spinal anesthetic is a little bit different, and it's not usually something that they go to as a first line. It's like epidurals are much more common, but like say you have a planned cesarean, usually, well, it depends on the hospital, but sometimes they'll go spinal anesthetic for that cesarean versus epidural for the cesarean. Sometimes if you're like trying to give vaginal birth for twins, they will sort of like force you, make you, or they really highly suggest that you get an epidural placed in the event that. And even if you were like trying to do it, wanting to do it naturally, because they're like, well, say we need to go for like a really quick cesarean, something starts to turn, or maybe like one baby comes out fine and the other one's not coming out fine. We can turn this into like a surgical epidural by increasing the meds really quickly. Something like
what
that.
What is so better if you, you had a choice? I mean, maybe you don't ever have a choice, but is a spinal or an epidural one way better?
For like normal labor pain relief?
Or, yeah, I guess. Yeah. Anything. I mean, I guess you wouldn't do a spinal if it was just normal labor pain, but like for a C-section, would they always do a spinal and not an epidural or vice versa? Like, is one better than the other? Why don't they always do epidurals? Like, just takes longer.
Well, I think it's just probably if you have a planned cesarean, like you have a breech baby and you have a schedule and you go in, they're probably going to do a spinal. It wears off after 2 hours. It's just a one-time injection. There's no continuous catheter. There's no like, you know, but if you have an epidural and you're going through labor and then something crashes out and you have to have an emergency, they're not going to like change it to a spinal. They'll just increase the meds and it will work fine still for a cesarean. But a spinal, I guess, has a preference if you, because it'll like it's just like a one-time thing. You don't have to have something continuously in your back. I don't know. I don't know. There's probably some more nuances there about the way that everything's going.
Yeah, like I wish that they would have given me an epidural with Cade instead of a spinal, because when I woke up out of my C-section, out of general, I had zero pain management. And yeah. like having your abdomen yeah, like cut point. Open and a baby ripped out of you and then you have zero pain support, it's like, oh.
Well, and with your spinal, it should have worked and it just
right,
didn't.
But even it if
didn't,
it wears something about off it after work. 2 hours, I mean, if you're in surgery for, you know, 30 minutes or whatever, I mean, at that point, they would give
you true. Normal. And I mean, they should have given you more. They should have like, I don't understand what no, happened there because they should have accounted for the fact that that didn't work and you were not going to have any pain medication. Yeah, you were under anesthesia, but that's not pain medication. No, that's just knocking you out.
Yeah, it's very fun to wake up to that. Like you want to see your baby for the first time and then you're like in excruciating pain. So in hindsight, personally, I wish that they would have given me an epidural because then I would have been.
Where like you didn't have that with Avia's birth though, because you had an epidural.
So I felt nothing. I mean, my feeling and my C-section area didn't come back until at least like a day or two after having the C-section. It was still like really painful and sore, but nothing like coming right out of surgery with no pain support.
I wonder if that has to do with like, do they continue to pump meds through the epidural or do they, I don't know. That's a good nuance. Or do they, were they just medicating you better after Avia and they just for some reason didn't?
Well, I don't know. I had the epidural. So I think I was just getting meds through that. I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, and it was.
Yeah, it's a good question. Like when do they start to shut it off? I don't know.
Good question.
Okay, sorry. I should know that, guys. That's a new one.
That's okay. I mean, I know it too. It happened to me. I'm a doctor. I don't just like, I don't know. But
yeah, these are like,
these are good questions to ask your doctor, you know?
As we're talking about birth and postpartum support, I want to share an underrated tip with you. That tip is to continue taking your prenatal. Pregnancy and postpartum are the most nutritionally demanding phases of a woman's life. Many women stop taking their prenatal after birth, but we recommend taking it for at least the first 9 months postpartum or the entirety of the time that you're breastfeeding. My favorite prenatal is Needed's Prenatal Multi, and it's the most robust formula that I've seen in the market. It contains bioavailable nutrients in their evidence-based dosages, well above the bare minimum that a lot of prenatals settle for. Their quality standards are top tier with transparent third-party testing and over 10,000 practitioners now recommending the brand. And now we have the results from their IRB-approved clinical study that confirm the results of what we've been seeing clinically. Women who take the prenatal multi have significantly higher blood levels of critical nutrients for pregnancy and postpartum. This includes vitamin D, B6, B12, riboflavin, vitamin K2. Only women in the Needed group reach the adequate, sufficient levels of vitamin D. Vitamin D plays a big role in your immune health, your mood, and your energy production, all things that are really important during your postpartum season. And while there's many different ways that you can support yourself postpartum, continuing to take your prenatal is a really simple, easy way to cover all your bases. It's one of the most impactful habits that we can have, and Needed makes it easy. Learn more about the study at thisisneeded.com/thrive and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20% off your first order. Yes, healthy mother, like a little affirmation for yourself. Yeah, how do you guys manage it afterwards? Okay, so how's it placed? So it's the needle is going to go into your epidural space, which is just this like very small space surrounding the spinal cord. It's not like the needle goes into the spinal cord. And then, yeah, like I said earlier, there's not a hard needle in your back the entire time. You are like sitting there at the edge of the bed, usually curled over, trying to press your lower back out, sort of like a cat, like a scared cat. You have to be very, very still. And, you know, tell them if you're having a contraction because you're going to need to like not be in that position during a contraction. Sometimes I feel like they sort of force you to anyways. And you may, if they're in the middle of placing it and you have a contraction, you just have to deal with that and stay in your very still curled over position, which would be really, really difficult. Hopefully you only have to experience like one in that position. It can take 10 to 15 minutes for them to place it though. So depending on how active labor you are, you may have multiple contractions in that time period. If for some reason the sitting up position's not working, they can do it while you're side lying. It's just like not the preference. They like want you to bring your knees up to your chest and yeah, like not ideal, but most of the time they're done sitting at the edge of the bed. And again, they're going to do a little lidocaine injection first at the skin, just like if you were to get a skin biopsy or something at the dentist, like whatever, just so that you don't feel that needle going in. Then they do the needle, they feed the catheter through, they pull the needle back out, they tape everything to your back. The catheter is attached to a little pump that they also tape, and it's just sitting there. Okay, so then it takes about like 5 to 10 minutes for the initial effect to bleed into your body, not bleed in, but like to diffuse in so that you feel it. And then the full effect usually takes like another 15 to 20 minutes. So It's pretty quick. It's not instantaneous. I think sometimes people think it's going to be like they don't want to feel anything right away. Whereas a spinal anesthetic is instantaneous. It's like a very quick action thing. Okay, when can it not be placed? When can you not get an epidural? Well, when can it? There is sometimes. Well, actually, let's talk about when can you not get one. If you have a very low platelet count, they're not going to do it. If you have some certain bleeding disorders, they're not going to do it. If you have any known allergic reactions to different anesthesia, they're not going to do it. If you have an infection on the skin of your back, obviously that makes sense. They're not going to be able to do that. It's kind of a rare one, but it's true. And then if you're too far progressed, like if they think you're going to be pushing sooner, if you're very, very dilated, they're just going to say like, you've reached the point. Okay. And also if you're very, very early on, they often won't do them then, but sometimes hospitals are giving epidurals at like 2 centimeters, which I have a problem with, and I'll talk about that later. The ideal time to do it is when you are in good active labor. I would say like there was a historical time where if a woman was like 4 to 5 centimeters, they would just do it no matter the contraction pattern, no matter like how things were progressing, what was happening. It was just like, oh, this number. But as we've learned, cervical dilation is not a linear thing. It's not predictable. It's not what we thought it was. It can change really rapidly. You can be 4 to 5 centimeters walking around with no contractions, like 39 weeks pregnant. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't mean anything. Or you can be 4 to 5 centimeters having had 24 hours of every 4 minutes apart contractions, and baby's just probably like in a malposition if you're not dilating past that. But anyway, you don't want to get it too early. You don't want to get it too late. There's like a sweet spot there. But I do say ideally you want to wait as long as you can, like right before transition, sometime maybe like 6-7 centimeters, 6-7, something like that. But it's hard to manage that. And at the end of the day, like with calling the anesthesiologist and getting them in the room, and it all does take time. So you want to account for that as well. Okay, so the different kinds of the ways that epidurals can be used. So we kind of touched on this, but like most of it is going to be during active labor. That's sort of the normal thing. And it's going to really anchor you to the bed. You won't be able to move, or your legs will feel very heavy or completely numb, something like that. Then you can get a lower dose of the medication for something called a walking epidural. But most hospitals are not going to actually allow you to walk. Like sometimes though, you do see pictures or videos of people with the IV pole and they're like walking around really slowly with somebody sort of supporting them. But that is rare. Usually what a walking epidural means is that like you can feel your legs and you can move around with a lot more autonomy, but you'd still be considered too unstable to literally walk. But it's just sort of, it takes the pain off, edge off. But then also more than anything, you can feel pushing a lot better and connect to that feeling, which has its benefits. Or sometimes people will get a full epidural later, earlier in their labor, and then they turn it way down when it comes time to push. Then there's the kind that, like prior to a cesarean for something, some reason, like maybe you were trying to like a VBAC, sometimes they'll place it because you're attempting, you're doing a TOLAC, a trial of labor. After cesarean is TOLAC, TOLAC. And they're sort of expecting you to just go in for another cesarean. So they place it ahead of time. And then they can just increase it if they need to for the cesarean. But anyways, so that's kind of the ways that goes. And then side effects. So this is the big one. This is the big one that I feel like a lot of people worry about, want to know about. But here's the thing. Before we talk about side effects, when's a really good time to get an epidural? I'll just like rattle off some ideas. If you did no labor prep, you have no idea what's going on. You don't have any support. You did not, like, you were not prepared for this. I don't know if it's a good idea to just crush it out then, because I do think it takes preparation, mental preparation mostly, and having some support systems, because otherwise it could really shock you. You may be one of those anomaly people who it's fine and you just work through it and you grit through it and it's whatever. But I would say most of the time, successful unmedicated births are in a situation where somebody like really has a lot of support and awareness of how to like deal with it, movement, breathing, breath work, stuff like that. Okay. You've had a very long, long, long labor and you're at the point of exhaustion. This is one of my favorite things to say, is that birth is really important. Yes. And at the end of it, at the end of labor and birth, what are you going to get? You are going to get a baby. Yeah. And you have to mother that baby. And motherhood is its whole own thing. The birth does really matter, but sometimes people can get mentally stuck there and they stop and they'll do anything they can, like just for the hell of it, to not get meds. And it's like, whoa, but if you can't mother your baby now because you are so beyond yourself, we have to also manage our energy stores there.
I mean, that was a big reason I had to have a C-section. I have made it in my mind that it was my choice, but it did help me make that choice because your voice was in my ear being like, the minute you give birth, there is now a baby and there is no pause button on that. Like, you can't just like give the baby back. You can't just be like, oh no, I need just 12 hours to just catch up on sleep. It's like those days are gone. They are gone. So you are up, you know, every 2 hours for the rest of, you know, the next few weeks or months. And I remember you saying that and being like, okay, I've been in labor for like 56 hours. And is it worth continuing to push to try to have this like vaginal birth? And like, obviously there's like sadness there of like how it happened, but that the biggest decision in my mind and what brought me peace going into my C-section was that like, at least I won't be so exhausted that I can't be present for my baby, you know?
Yeah. And breastfeeding and all of the things. And, you know, some people probably listening to this would say, yeah, but you're physiologically, you get this like high and you get a boost of energy, and yeah, you do. But I don't know. I just, in working in this field, you know, I've heard of the situations where people cram it out just because that was, you know, it was really important to them. And I understand that. But then it's like the whole point is
to do no harm,
to get the baby,
to do no harm, right?
Yes. Like, why are you in labor is to have a child. And once your child is here, I don't know. It's a tricky edge because I don't advocate for people to just have their epidurals as plan A in most instances. But I know that that is the case. And that's just because I think that there can be a lot of benefit gained in physiological birth, a medicated birth, both for the mom and for the baby. A lot of benefit there. And so that's why I don't say it to be plan A, but I also understand why people do get them, you know. And exhaustion, especially in a first time mom, is sort of one of the biggest things you're up against. And if we can go and get an epidural and sleep a little bit and still have a vaginal birth, there's the hierarchy in the way things go, you know. Vaginal birth still would supersede cesarean in the cases where it's possible. So if we need to not push her to the nth degree where she's like unable to participate and is crashing out, and not crashing out like in a, you know, heart attack kind of way, but I just mean like mentally. Yeah.
I mean, like, I think the best situation, as I'm sure you know very well, you see all the time, but like, we have a friend who was laboring really, really hard, so exhausted, so, so tough, wanted a, you know, vaginal birth, and then finally does the epidural, she falls asleep, and in that time, you know, this is the dream situation that everyone wishes, doesn't happen for me, but falls asleep and then dilates to 10 centimeters because her body could finally relax, and then they turn the epidural down. Yep. She could feel it, you know, a little bit, but still had some pain relief, and then was able to have the baby vaginally after having that rest that her body like vitally needed and probably wouldn't have been able to get without the epidural. So I can see where it could be very gentle and helpful in that regard.
Yeah. And that's a really common story. Like, how many times have we heard that story where, yeah, they just go to sleep, they finish dilating, they wake up to pressure, and they push the baby out. And that is, and at the end of the day, that is the more common experience of getting an epidural. There are these horror stories too, which we're going to talk about the side effects, and you do need to know about the side effects. And at the same time, just like with inductions, as much as I don't think that an unnecessary medical induction should be the standard because you do put yourself at more risk, a lot of people go through with inductions and everything's fine. And so, you know, when we talk about these things, like, it's going to be terrible. It's like, it's not actually the experience of the majority of people. But what is sad to me is when people never have heard about the other side, and then they are blindsided because they're like, well, wait, every one of my friends, every one of the women in my family went and had an epidural and it was great. And then I was left with one that didn't work and a spinal headache and traumatic cesarean and da 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 da, whatever. You know, like they're just that person that where like all these things happen to. It's that's really unfortunate. And this is literally just informed consent. Mm-hmm. Why do they not sit down and tell you all the things? Or maybe they give you that sheet and you know you don't actually read mm-hmm. it. And it's just it's not. It's like when with your birth with Avia, that doctor that came in and gave you the most beautiful informed consent ever about your induction. She was like, listen, I'm comfortable having you be on Pitocin for another 2 or 3 mm-hmm. days. That's what she said.
And I don't even remember that.
You'd had the epidural. Yeah, you had the epidural, but it was only working on one side of your body. And so you were like very uncomfortable and you were trying to, well, it was like, I don't know. It wasn't working perfectly well. You weren't completely numbed and comfortable mm-hmm. is my point. And she was down. She was like, you know, we can do that. And that people rock on with that a lot, mm-hmm. but she's like, but I'll be honest with you. It's going to take a long time. Yeah. Like this is going to be a big road. Or she's like, you can go for cesarean right now mm-hmm. and we can be calm and slow with it. And, you know, it was just so cool to hear her acknowledge the trajectory and the path of what was
became my choice, and I'm sure in her mind she's like, yeah. I really hope she chooses this option, but there was no coercing and there was no pressure. And I truly, because people are like, oh my god, you have a C-section, like was that so traumatic? And this is what I talk about all the time. It's usually not the thing, it's the reason behind the thing that has meaning. Like everything is neutral in life. Like I say that a lot. Everything is neutral. We put meaning behind it, positive or negative. And for me, I felt like even though I did not want a C-section, and I have had 2 now that I didn't want, and I've had the year-long recovery that I have for some reason with them, that's less than ideal. But in that moment, it felt like my choice and it felt empowered. It wasn't a choice I would have chosen, but it still felt like my choice. And that really made all the difference, where I look back on my births and neither of them really, I feel like it's traumatic other than waking up with no pain meds with Cade. That was not ideal. But that part was less ideal. But yeah, that first doctor, it just, this is the power of informed consent, like you said, and empowering women to be like, we are not waving a magic wand that says, do the natural stuff, everything will be hunky-dory. Do the conventional stuff, everything will be hunky-dory. Nothing bad will ever happen. Everything will be perfect, or everything bad will happen. It's like, this is literally like what it is. And we have to weigh in every single moment with every single patient, all of this complex stuff. And at the end of the day, you should be the one to be able to choose and know and make that choice no matter what is happening.
Yeah, unless it's emergency life-saving. But other than that, a lot of the time that's not where we're getting, or we get to that point of emergency life-saving because of a slew of interventions that we were not given choice about. And it's like, why can't they just, I don't know. Anyways. Okay. So before we talk about side effects, one more really big scenario where I think epidurals, there's a slew of reasons why they could be good. And especially in the situation of the first time mom and exhaustion, I just feel like there's a lot of shame. This was one of the questions that came up in off of Instagram, was like, how do you release the shame of getting one, especially after many hours of natural birth? Mm-hmm. And then you just like, it wasn't working. It wasn't happening. Well, I mean, like you said, we are putting the meaning on it. So you can really, the only thing you can do is to frame shift in your own mind and have a conversation with yourself of, in that moment, this is what I needed to do in order to like cope with the reality before mm-hmm. me. I had tried this, that, and the other thing, da, 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 da. It's harder, I think, when women maybe like wanted to try something different and they didn't, or, you know, they were disappointed. Maybe like the doula couldn't show up, or the tub, they weren't allowed in the water. I don't know. I'm just trying to think of like some examples where they thought like, well, maybe if I had been able to do mm-hmm. that, it would have been mm-hmm. different. But here's the thing. We can play a million what if scenarios in our brains. And at the end of the day, it just is what it is. Like, I can think about the same sorts of stuff with my son's nursing experience. And, well, if I had only just gone to like a different IBCLC, or I had gotten a second opinion earlier, or if this had happened, if that had happened, maybe it all would have been different. It's like, yeah, okay, well, that's not my reality, mm-hmm. though. I don't have a time machine. I can't go back, and neither can you. And you chose what you needed to do, and you tried. And sometimes, yeah, you're like, wow, I prepped for that. I thought that was going to be, you know, maybe you got the epidural because the pain was like too much and you were like, I cannot handle this. This is insane. What is going on? And it really blindsided you, and it made you disappointed in yourself and your abilities, because you were like, I thought I was going to be able to do that. Why couldn't I, what was going on? Why couldn't I do that? And something to learn there, I think, is just that, first of all, fetal positioning is a big deal. Having a malpositioned baby can increase the severity of contractions by a lot. Like having an OP, so occiput posterior baby, aka like sunny side up, is going to make contraction patterns really sort of like erratic. Sometimes you can have double contractions. You have the pain in your back. You have back labor. And then you're not dilating at a really good pattern because of the positioning of their head on your cervix. So it's like you do all this work at like 0.5 speed of dilation, where when you have a really optimally positioned baby, it's just different. So sometimes there's factors like that that are you didn't know about at the time. And like now, next time you're going into it, you can make that a different choice of like having someone assess or have a doula that can help you with baby positioning. This is where I love the Gilligan's Guide information, which we have a whole episode. We'll put it in the show notes, where I interview Anne Gilligan, and she talks extensively about this idea of fetal positioning and preventing the primary cesarean, which I do think Avia must have been asynclitic. She may not have been OP, but I think she was asynclitic, and it was preventing you from getting good pressure on your cervix to dilate. Even though we knew your contractions were strong, something was going
well,
on.
Well, and then one thing I want to say about this too is just the guilt. Is even I hear this sometimes. I'll ask people how their births went, and I'm just like, wow, that sounds really nice. Like it just happened. It's like how I feel when people get pregnant. Like you just had sex and then you just got pregnant. Like that's so crazy. And, you know, and then I think about mine where I was vomiting for, you know, an entire 24 hours straight. And that just, not everybody's experience is the same. And so when you see other women to be like, oh, well, she had a vaginal birth at home in 3 hours, you know, she just like popped the baby out. And then like, I did this, like something must be wrong with me, or like, I'm not strong enough, or I can't handle pain, or I can't do whatever. It's like, if you were in her experience, you probably would have rocked it, you know, because she was given a different experience. It doesn't mean that she is better or worse than you because she was able to do X, Y, Z and you weren't. Like, you were given different circumstances and different challenges, and no one is going to know what it's like to be in you. You know, no one can be in each other's space. And so the comparison of others, I think, is where a lot of this shame comes from. Because if you just go internally with you and say, for whatever reason, this isn't what happened for me. Maybe it was my soul curriculum, something my soul was meaning to learn. Maybe my baby needed it for some reason. Or, you know, maybe this is an experience for me to start to like trust myself and, you know, come back into myself or whatever. Like, your experience is not anybody else's. And so you just can't compare it, because if you were in somebody else's, you might have had a completely different experience. And you just can't put that reflection of who you are as a mother or a person or your strength or anything on the outcome of what happened, in my opinion.
Electrolytes are trending, yes, but they have been in need of our human bodies for all of time. And if you're drinking another popular and delicious salty electrolyte, here's why you should be drinking Relight instead. First of all, have you ever considered the salt source of these other brands? Because most of them just use table salt. Yeah, table salt. You don't want that. Redmond's Relight Powders uses their unrefined ancient sea salt that they mine in Utah. This salt source contains 60 plus trace minerals along with calcium, chloride, potassium, and magnesium in two different forms, glycinate and malate. The minerals that they use in the Relight Powders are all in the appropriate proportions and forms too. The metabolic needs of pregnancy, healing postpartum, and milk making require more minerals than in other times of your life. Pregnancy itself demands huge increases in your blood volume, which takes, you know, more minerals. Relight is the perfect blend to be sipping during your pregnancy or during your labor even, and especially while you're breastfeeding. It tastes amazing, and my favorite flavors oscillate between mixed berry, lemon lime, and the strawberry lemonade. But you can try a sample pack and try all the flavors for yourself and see what you think. Use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 15% on your entire Redmond order. That includes their OG sea salt, other seasonings, bentonite clays, toothpaste, and more. I love that. Yeah, exactly. And the other point I was going to say is like trauma survivors. And that's something that people, you don't necessarily need to broadcast when you're telling your birth story, that that's part of your story. But sometimes that kind of pain, it's not worth the nervous system triggering, the PTSD that happens, and being able to numb that and not experience it is the most beneficial move that the mom can make, you know, in that moment. And it's, again, it's harm reduction. Yes, there's benefits of natural birth. Yes, there is more increased risk, and your mental emotional experience of this is also very important. One thing that does bother me is the mindset of I'm not going to, and this is totally up for everybody to make their decision, but it does bother me because I think that it comes with a missing of the point of a lot of human experience is the mindset of people being like, I'm not even going to like consider the idea of natural birth. I go and slap me the epidural the second that I start to feel contractions. I don't want to feel anything. I don't want to be a part of this birth at all. I want to sit there and watch TV and eat like donuts and have a full face of makeup and be doing my like extensions and whatever, you know, that type of person. You've all seen those people. And it's like, okay, to each their own. I get it. That's their life. But I'm like, it's like to me, the Hunger Games and the, what was it called?
The Capital.
It's very much like the Capital in the Hunger Games where it's like so far removed from what our nature is. And because that is something I highly value, obviously it would make sense. I would think this. If you're one of those people, I'm not trying to shame you. I'm just trying to explain my stance on this, which is like, what about the whole point of it? What about the fact that no one did this for millennia with billions and billions of births up until the last 200 years where we started to fiddle around, you know? What about like the potential benefits of this rite of passage? What about this? Like you don't even want to try to like learn about it. You're just going to shame anybody. You're like, why would you ever want to do that? Like, and then they have this very negative mindset, like that we're putting ourselves through torture and that we're, or like, oh, well, you think you're like so strong, you know, you're not going to get an award for that. Mm-hmm. Like blah, blah, blah. Like that mindset whole thing really, really bugs me. Also, epidurals should never be plan A. It can be plan A.5. But sometimes, y'all, it doesn't work. And let's talk about that. So let's talk about the side effects. Okay. So we'll get there in the statistics about this. But so some of the common and known side effects or risks to mom, and then we'll talk about them to baby. So low blood pressure. This is something that just is a physiological drop that's happening because of the nature of putting something in your spine or, you know, in your epidural space. So they'll remedy it with saline, like IV fluids. And sometimes they have to give ephedrine too. If you have naturally low blood pressure, you know, be ready for that to be a part of it. You may not even feel it. They may be just like counteracting it in the moment. You may pass out because of your low blood pressure. So there's, that can happen. So that's something to know. I think it surprises people. And then 15 to 25% of women are going to have a fever. That's a medication-based reaction fever to the epidural. They're not exactly sure what's going on there with like the thermal regulation, but something is affected. But because of this, that, I mean, first of all, fevers suck, but because we don't know if it's from the epidural or if there's from an infection going on in you, your baby may have to undergo sepsis evaluation later after they're born. And that might include blood cultures, preventative antibiotics, NICU observations, spinal taps for your baby, your brand new baby. So that is a big deal. And that's between 15 and 25% of people will have some level of fever with an epidural. Now, a good doctor should be able to look at the affect of the baby and say, this baby is fine. And most of the time they do that. They try to do it a good assessment without having to go through all of that. But if there's, you know, if it's been a long, prolonged labor and the baby comes out and is having a little bit of a hard time to start or is very sleepy, they might go as you would want them to say, well, maybe this baby is like sick. And the only way we'll know is if we do some testing. And so that's just kind of scary because it's like your baby may undergo unnecessary things. Okay. You also have like reduced mobility. Obviously you can't move around. And this really impacts fetal positioning because the baby is not just like getting squeezed out like a tube of toothpaste. The baby is rotating and moving and navigating the bones of your pelvis. It's so interesting. It's part of their innate reflexes to turn this way, rotate that way, tuck their chin, do all these things. They're called the cardinal movements. You guys should watch a YouTube video on it. It's really cool. And so when we are now stagnant and not moving our pelvises and like laying, even if you're, you know, it is ideal if you have an epidural to have somebody helping you change positions every 30 to 60 minutes, unless you're like dead asleep, then sleep. But then you need to be moved. So left side, right side, sitting up, like supported over the edge of the back of the bed, like on your knees with a bunch of pillows underneath your butt so that you're not having to hold yourself up, but like you get that different kind of positioning so the baby can navigate and use the contractions that are pushing them and squeezing them to get their little heads through your bones and their shoulders, because they can't just fit in one way. They have to rotate their shoulders, the width of the pelvis. Just like when you guys put one of those little, like, you know, a square peg in a round hole or something, those little toys, you have to like turn them and push them just in a, just so to get them to move through. So the reduced mobility is a big deal, because this is where like, oh, okay, the contractions, you know, we need to give in Pitocin, which I'll talk about in a second too. So now we have Pitocin on board and the contractions are squeezing really, really hard. And it's like baby's trying to move, but it's really difficult to do it when mom's not moving.
I have a question. And, can I interrupt?
Yeah.
Do they know, and you might not know the answer to this, but because they're giving you like spinal block and also some morphine type, fentanyl type things, does that make the baby lower movement too? Like they're just chilling, like I don't need to like move my body to get out of here, like, you know, or does it not come to the baby at all?
Good question. So the thought is that because the dose is so low that it's not going to affect the baby that much.
So they're
it's
not really like a lazy, very, very, like not doing their cranial movements.
No.
Okay, cool.
No, but I mean, you know, the doulas and the midwives and the people will say that babies that are born on epidurals are way less perky than babies that aren't. But I mean, I don't know. I feel like too, it depends on the length of the labor. Mm-hmm. Like if a baby was working really hard and is really tired, they may just come out like that. It may be about the way they start, but I mean, yes, your baby is going to get exposed. So if you want no exposure to your baby, then don't get an epidural, but it's not going to be like they're born super, super drugged. I think that that's a myth that people in the natural birth world want to perpetuate to scare people from getting these. Okay. But so the reduced mobility though is honestly one of my biggest gripes with an epidural, because of all of the sequelae of a baby now having a harder time navigating your contractions, not, you know, serving that process. And maybe baby rotates into a fetal position that's not optimal. Maybe they rotate into OP and now you can't really move around to help them rotate back. Blah, 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 blah. Okay. Like it's just a very classic thing. Epidurals do increase the overall length of labor by about an hour, which is like not crazy in the grand scheme of things. And then they do increase the pushing phase about 30 minutes to 60 minutes on average. So there is a little bit of longer phasing in those two sections there. Also, it does increase your risk of use of vacuum and forceps for sure. That's a very well documented one, because again, baby not being able to navigate and move and getting sort of like stuck on the way out. Whereas if you could be moving your hips, moving things around, it would be a lot more helpful to them. Using an epidural is going to almost always involve some level of coached pushing where they're like telling you when your contraction is happening because you can't feel it, or you can feel some pressure, you know, but if, unless you've like taken the step to turn the epidural down prior to that, sometimes you're very numb and you have no idea. And so you'll be pushing for longer. You're pushing very, very hard at the instruction of other people and not really listening to your body. And so there is an increase then for the sequelae like tearing and maybe potentially, you know, pelvic organ prolapse or issues like that with the pelvic floor later on. Then there's some things that are random things like urinary retention, itching, shivering, some things like that that can happen. But then, yeah, sometimes it doesn't work, or sometimes it only works on one side. And so the rate of the statistical rate of it not working at all is like 5 to 10%. Sometimes they'll go back in and try to replace it because they just didn't put it in the right spot. And if they don't put it in the right spot, yeah, it's not going to work. Or with it partially working, like working on one side, that's a 10 to 20% risk. And so when people have this as their plan A, that's not even the reason why I don't think they should have the plan A. The main reason they should have not plan A is because sometimes the anesthesiologist is very busy and they cannot get to you and your baby may be born in that time, you know, and, or you're just like having a hell of an experience because you did no prep of how to manage yourself and manage these contractions. I just think everybody should have really, really good tools of, this is how I'm going to breathe. This is how I'm going to move, partner or doula. This is how you're going to support me. I really want to get an epidural. And I'm going to try to wait as long as I can. I'm going to get into a really good contraction pattern. Also, in the back of my mind, I'm acknowledging the truth and the fact and the reality that I may not get one. So then What am I going to do? I'm going to be okay. I'm going to need your guys' extra support. I really, really want one. But if I don't get one, I know it'll be okay. That, I think, should be the mindset.
I love that.
Okay, now these headaches, these like spinal headaches that can happen. They're technically called post-dural puncture headaches because the needle will go through the thick connective tissue called the dura. This is happening in like one in every 100 to 200 cesarean, or sorry, epidurals. So this is not like a super duper common thing, but when it happens, it really sucks. Yeah. Okay, so it's a very severe headache. And it can last like, you know, a week on average, sometimes a couple of weeks. And then rarely it'll last several weeks. Somebody did ask me a question on Instagram, like, if I have back pain months and months later, could that be from that? And I couldn't find any information about that as a particular, maybe it's just because it's really difficult to prove that that's still why it's happening. But if this happens and you're in the hospital still recovering from birth and you know that it's going on, and they'll do something called a blood patch. And a blood patch works immediately. And it works in about 70 to 90% of these spinal headache situations. It's basically where they just, in that same space, they are injecting some of the patient's blood. And it sort of like blocks up with a clot the leak in cerebral spinal fluid. Because when we puncture that dura, it's like you've created a small hole in a balloon. And now there's this fluid that's leaking out. It's called cerebral spinal fluid. And that's also like the same type of fluid that they do test when they do a spinal tap. Cerebral spinal fluid is what's moving around during craniosacral therapy. Like, it's a cool thing, but it bathes your whole brain and your whole spinal cord, and it's not supposed to get out. It's supposed to stay where it is. And if it gets out, it can cause terrible pain. So you basically are using your own blood to make like a dam at that hole. It's kind of cool. It's like making a Band-Aid with your own blood clotting. And it works really well. So a blood patch is the remedy for that. And it doesn't always work, but most of the time. One other thing about using epidurals is that there will be an increased coexistence of now using Pitocin, because there is a natural slowing and weakening of the contractions that happen after the epidural is placed in many women, most women. If the longer you wait, though, to get it, the less likely that is to happen. Because if you're, say, 7 centimeters having really, really good contractions, you're less likely to need Pitocin than if you were at like 4 centimeters, you're still sort of in early labor, and now you're needing to get Pitocin on board. Pitocin infinitely complicates things. So in terms of risk, we now have to take on all the Pitocin risks, because this is where babies have more D-cells. They're having a harder time handling these longer, stronger contractions, especially if they cannot rotate possibly, you know, positionally. And I'm not going to go into all of those. But so then there is this like big myth, I think. Well, it's not a myth. It's a very complex factor. And this is where research sucks, about epidurals leading to cesareans. So when we look at just the data that we have that says, what's the rate of cesarean in general with no epidural? What's the rate of cesarean with epidural? They're actually the exact same. But I think, though, that it makes a lot of sense looking at all of these other factors. You are leading now to a cascade of interventions that's infinitely hard to control for in a research setting that is going to potentially increase your risk of needing a cesarean section. Also, we do know certain instances with epidural do increase your cesarean risk. They're just small, like knowing there's a malposition baby, or if they place it too early. Those two things do bump up the risk. But they say that, like, on the average Joe Schmo epidural, that your cesarean risk is the same. And I just don't believe it, that it's a real life setting of the way that things go down, because they can't control for all of those multitude of complicating factors that happen later. Okay. And then some very rare things that can happen. Like, you know, you can be allergic to certain components of the epidural. You could have a nerve injury if they place it in the wrong spot. You could have something called an epidural abscess or an epidural hematoma, you know, like where blood accumulates in those spaces. But those are pretty
rare. The woman who asked about the back pain, I mean, it's possible that they could have injured a nerve.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
So it depends on what the nature of the back pain is, but it could have also been from.
But then I also am thinking about
and holding a baby and doing lots of things.
And like having a diastasis, and now your lower back is destabilized,
you have no core.
And the connection with pelvic floor, and you know, it's hard to be able to pinpoint. I guess so. To answer the question, it's possible, but is it the first thing I would think of? Yeah. No. So it would, yeah, it would be depending upon a lot of things, like you said, the nature of the pain. Okay, the effects on the baby. So the effects on the baby, there can be some temporary fetal heart changes, which sounds scary, but they're usually not actually that scary. There's, you know, because of the need, the increased risk of needing forceps or vacuum, there's less than ideal things that happen to the baby with those, like on the minor end, you know, scalp or face bruising. On the more extreme end, they can give it the baby like a head hematoma. They can crush spaces in the inner ear or sinuses. That sounds really terrible. And sometimes it is a big deal. And sometimes, you know, if the baby was really, really struggling, we have to get the baby out right the second, then it's a risk we take. Craniosacral therapy is always something that I would suggest, you know, to every single baby, but especially a baby born with vacuum or forceps. Very, very important in my opinion. Yes, there is this, the medication transfer. So the opioids getting to the baby, it's a small dose. The effects are minimal, but they are there. So yes, that is happening. That's a myth. Sometimes I've heard OBGYNs tell people, not in front of me, but like in conferences or on videos, being like, the baby doesn't get any of the medication. It doesn't affect the baby. And it's like, what are you talking? Why do you not know that? Like, is it completely knocking them out? No, but you can't say that. I've had people tell me that the reason why they're going to get an epidural is because they learned that it doesn't affect the baby. And so they're fine with it. And I'm like, that is not true. Let me tell you, that is not true. Okay. And then the sepsis evaluation stuff is the other big main one. Like, you know, the sequelae that happens to them because they get unnecessary antibiotics, they get unnecessary blood cultures and pokes, which like that's overall not that big of a deal. I mean, it's not comfortable to get a blood draw, but more like, you know, separation via NICU observation, antibiotics, spinal tap. Those are big deals.
Spinal tap in a baby is a big deal. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Very sad. Very, very big deal there. A couple other questions from Instagram were, is there any association with feeling like a delayed feeling of bonding or increased postpartum depression? And the evidence on this is very mixed. So there is some studies that say yes, there is some studies that say no. And then of course there's the anecdotes of women who've had different birth experiences. And it's easy, I think, for our brains to say the reason why, okay, so like this would be a very common experience. First birth, hospital planned, they get an epidural, something is kind of crazy and out of control with it. Maybe it ends in more intervention than they wanted to. Maybe it doesn't. Baby is born. They have their experience. Second birth, they go, you know, I'm not going to do that. And also it's a second birth. So it's like a lot usually smoother, faster, whatever. Maybe they have it in a different location. And now they're having this completely different experience. And they're going to point back to it and say, it's because of the epidural. And it's like, well, there's a lot of factors. You were a totally different person. That was a different labor. It was a different everything. It's just hard to tease out. But some women will say, yes, without a shadow of a doubt, it affected things. It's hard to know. What we do know is that postpartum depression and lack of bonding are, it's a multifactorial like picture. And pretend there's like five different colors in the picture. And each of those colors is a factor like lack of support, breastfeeding difficulties, traumatic birth. Okay, well, breastfeeding difficulties and traumatic birth can both be tied into epidural use. Yes. And so maybe there is a component of it. It's just not necessarily direct. Yeah. It's not like because of the epidural. It's sort of like all the other things.
Like I had an epidural, but my breastfeeding was easy. I did not have any postpartum depression. I had a great postpartum. I felt very happy, you know, but that doesn't mean that every person is going to. And also probably how your brain neurotransmitters are, how you handle, you know, anesthesia and morphine or, you know, fentanyl and all of those kind of things. Like if you have a history of addiction, like now it feels like you're kind of coming down off of something. Like there's so many things that could be playing a role. So I think it's just too multifactorial to be able to say one way or another.
Exactly. And like I've had four unmedicated births and I've had two that were really hard mentally and then two that were easier. One that was like amazing and then one that was like just normal. Okay. And then is there any link to early difficulties in breastfeeding or mastitis in early postpartum? Yes. So let's talk about that really quickly, which we've already talked about in the past, which is the idea that when you are on any level of IV fluids, because you got an epidural, because you're on Pitocin. So if you go get Pitocin, you're also on saline. If you get an epidural, you're not always on saline, But a lot of the time, yes. And then also because it leads to a lot of the time Pitocin, we're just going to like assume, mm-hmm. yes. If you get a cesarean, yes, you're getting mm-hmm. saline. So in any of these cases, your chance of the engorgement that you get after your baby is born is going to be a lot higher. It can make it harder for baby to latch. But the more immediate issue is that it pumps you and the baby full of IV fluids, which affects your overall weight, mm-hmm. the weight of the baby. And since we're going in ounces, you know, a couple of ounces really matters. And then now you're recovering from birth. Your baby has lost too much weight by day two or three. And they're saying, oh my gosh, see, like and it just derails your whole breastfeeding situation mm-hmm. because they're like, you need to supplement. You're not making enough milk. You know, at that point, you probably just only still have colostrum. Mm-hmm. It's like, guys, we need to have this be a known thing to soften and have nuance around and like, look at the baby, look at the latch, look at the output of pee and poop, say these few ounces, I'm not worried about, things are tracking up. We're going to just give it a couple more days because of accounting for the fact that there was some fluid mm-hmm. loss because of that saline. So that's the big one. But then also this engorgement aspect, it can be really difficult to get a baby to latch once our milk is coming in. So look into something like reverse pressure softening on YouTube, and that's a really great way to help you. Another question was, do people who respond poorly in general to general anesthesia, do they have a hard time with epidurals? No. So it's a different, usually no, it's a different mechanism. If for some reason you have a hard time with anesthesia, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have a hard time with an epidural. But obviously you need to talk to your doctor about this. Somebody said, why has it become the standard? Well, I think culturally, as we discussed earlier in the history section, as things kind of changed, and then with that Queen Victoria changing the narrative of like, it was something that was like moral and good. It was like what women needed to do. And then it was like acceptable to be like, no, let's block it. And that is just a cultural shift that happens. And then as time goes on, women go, oh my God, well, probably it was part of the feminist movement too, because they were like, yeah, hell yeah. I don't want to feel that. Why do I want to feel that? Like, why were women just dealing with this? And, da, 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 da. And that is, again, something that makes me feel sad, because I'm like, there is a lot of power and beauty in working through something that's
the
hard.
Hero's journey.
And
just the hero's journey.
And it doesn't always end up the way that we want and need, but why wouldn't we like try, I guess, is sort of the way that I think about it. Okay. Another question was, is pain relief worth all of the other hospital intervention risks compared to being at home? I mean, that's an individual question up to you. I do think it's a really good idea to know all of the things and move forward with it. To me, no. Like if I was having twins, I've thought about this before. If I was having twins, I would give birth in the hospital. I would not have a free birth because in Idaho, you can't do twins at home. I would give birth at the hospital. I would hire a doula, which I've not ever had like an official doula. I had a friend with my first birth acting as a doula, and she came at the very end, but she did actually like save the day. She was great. Sarah Duhon. Yeah. I'll always think about that because she was just a fresh pair of eyes and she saw me like not moving anymore during the contractions because I was so tired. I was just holding still and like grinning and bearing it. And she made me do squats on the toilet during some contractions and he moved down like inches. And finally I was able to connect to the feeling of pushing and boom. So she totally changed the trajectory of my labor because I was like, I was at my end point of exhaustion. So I would hire an official doula and I would be really mentally ready for them to make all kinds of different recommendations and stuff. But in that case, the risk is I'm willing to accept the risk. And if I needed a cesarean, then okay, because there could be more complications depending on like the types of twins they were and whatever. But for me, I choose to give it birth at home and grit it out. It's a normal human experience. It's not like you're choosing to have someone come to your house and take your femur and just snap it in half and then they hand you a baby. Like it's not like that. It's not, it's a progression. It's a very psychedelic experience. It's a very deep soul. I mean, you had hours and hours and hours of contractions too. So like, although your babies weren't born vaginally, you still have felt it. You know what labor is like. And I think, yeah, there is a difference maybe in being able to complete it and do like complete the loop with that. But like that feeling, that like getting, digging deep kind of thing. I don't know. I feel like we in our culture fear a lot. We fear death. We don't have any kind of death celebration the way that they do, say in like Mexico, Dia de los Muertos. Like we don't have any purpose in rites of passage where they had in indigenous cultures and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that the pain is the big thing. I think it's the mentality. Mm-hmm. It's staying on top of your own mentality and understanding what's going on. But again, this is outside of the situation of like trauma, abuse, yeah, whatever. So that's a complicated answer, but that's my short answer. And then the last one here was, do blood thinners prevent you from getting epidurals if you're on certain blood thinners? And yes, if you are on, if you have certain bleeding disorders or you are on certain medications, blood thinners being one of them, that is going to prevent you from getting an epidural in some cases. So, you know, that is not an option for you. So, so what that would look like is you're planning on unmedicated birth. And then if something goes awry and baby needs to be born right now, you would be put under general anesthesia. So you need to know that because they would not be able to give you an epidural or a spinal in that situation. And then you'd be present and awake during the cesarean. You would be unconscious. Mm-hmm. So those are conversations you have with your doctor just so that you're not shocked and surprised. Because as I've said on this podcast many times, one of the biggest sources of birth trauma, in my opinion, from working with, you know, hundreds of women and families in this space, probably thousands now, hearing so many stories, is the element of shock and surprise that they did not even know that what was happening to them was like a possibility, an option. They had no idea. They felt completely under, like with lack of control. And that was the thing that was causing, it was like the biggest source of trauma. It wasn't necessarily that they were transferred from home to the hospital. It wasn't necessarily that they had a cesarean. Like in your case, it's a perfect example because you had the power of choosing and being a part of that conversation. And, you know, when things are really scary and emergent, it is a different situation. Yeah. And of course, like most people would walk away from an emergency C-section feeling some level of traumatized, also some level of grateful because they're like, wow, that can, because birth, that's the thing. Birth is unpredictable and not all babies make it through birth. And that's kind of crazy to think about. So again, it's like we prepare ourselves. We try as hard as we can. The situation is going to intersect with reality. And thank God we have all of these medical interventions that we do so that we can save mothers and babies because people used to die at higher rates. And that's just the end of the story. Like, you can both be grateful that it happens or that we have the option and ability and say, I'm going to choose to work with my body, assuming everything is going to be okay until it's not. And then I will tap into this as needed. So,
so good.
That's what I got.
Another amazing episode of the School of Healthy as a Mother. This is great.
School
Thank
rock.
You so much, Dr. Morgan.
Are you pregnant or you're trying to conceive and you're looking for reliable natural health information about how to have a healthy pregnancy and also prepare for the future steps in motherhood to come, like the birth, the breastfeeding, and the postpartum? Because I have got you. So this is exactly the reason why I made the 6-week pregnancy call. And it's my most comprehensive resource. It's the thing that I absolutely love. I've poured my heart and soul into it. It's all of the things that I wish that every woman knew when they are entering motherhood. It's a pregnancy health course, birth prep series, breastfeeding 101 class, and a postpartum planning course all in one. And normally I run it as a class with live Q&A calls, but now it's available in a content-only format so that you can purchase it at any time and start learning immediately. It's called the lessons-only format, and it is just only all of the video lessons that you'll get access to for forever. So log on to milkmedicine.com/lessons-only or check out the link in the show notes.
In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and share with a friend who would benefit from this content. Please remember that the views and ideas from this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to be a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis and treatment of any disease. Consult with your provider before integrating any of this information into your own healthcare plan. A healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.